Hello, this is Funk McLovin. This is another lecture-style video slash audio file, this time about absurdism in Homestuck. Now, absurdism is kind of a popular philosophy, especially lately, with the popularity of shows like Rick and Morty and things of that nature. It's just something that has cropped up recently. Also, Albert Camus, who is the father of absurdism, is often assigned in high school. I think a lot of us remember reading The Stranger or other of his works. I think The Stranger is kind of a bad place to start with Camus, even though it is a very straightforward narrative. But if you're not familiar with absurdism, I'll give you a little rundown before I get into the video here. But basically, my thesis is Homestuck has a lot of themes of absurdism, and in fact is an absurd narrative, because Homestuck rejects a sort of normal philosophy of transcendent meaning, and it kind of embraces this rejection of existentialism as well as pre-existentialist thought, and comes into something new and whimsical and sort of more based in absurdism. So like I said, absurdism was developed by Albert Camus as a response to existentialism. A lot of people would call absurdism a type of existentialism. I don't really like this because I'm not a big fan of Nietzsche. And Albert Camus just has a lot more insight in a passionate sense than Nietzsche, who I consider to be kind of a big downer. That's an oversimplification, but this is a fucking video about Homestuck, so cut me some slack. The main work that I'm going to be quoting for this piece is The Myth of Sisyphus, which is something, like I said, a lot of people probably haven't read unless they're into philosophy already. The Myth of Sisyphus is an essay by Albert Camus, and the English translation of it from French is very dense, so I'm going to be quoting as best I can. I would suggest reading it, and I would suggest kind of rereading it, because it is, like I said, a very dense work. His prose is very, like, or not his prose, his writing style is incredibly, like, the man is a fucking genius, is what I'll say. And he's a little bit too smart for his own damn good, because sometimes I have to read his stuff over and over and over to just, like, kind of come to terms with what the fuck he means by it. Let's take this quote, for example. Man, and he's using man in the general sense here, in terms of, like, this is humanity, sentient beings. Man stands face to face with the irrational. He feels within him his longing for happiness and for reason. The absurd is born of this confrontation between the human need and the unreasonable silence of the world. And by the world, he means the universe at large. What does he mean by this? In a simpler way, it means that we are all born with a sort of curiosity and a determination, a will to power, as Nietzsche would call it. But we are kind of disappointed by the universe, and the answers to the questions that we ask, that we imbue with this transcendent meaning, are often very disappointing. For instance, we might say, what is the meaning of life? And the answer is kind of disappointing, depending on how you approach it. An evolutionary biologist might say, well, the meaning of life is to procreate. You know, a Christian might say the meaning of life is to serve God. And to me, at least, these are kind of disappointing on their face. They don't really, you know, really make sense to me. They just kind of seem like excuses. And what he's driving at here is that there is no meaning of life. It's all bullshit, and we're all going to die someday. But he has an answer to this existential quandary. And he takes this answer in the form of The Myth of Sisyphus, as the work is titled. Now, The Myth of Sisyphus calls back to a Greek myth. And I'm not going to go over the whole myth for brevity's sake. But the myth ends with a man named Sisyphus. He's a very arrogant king, Sisyphus. He's being punished by rolling a boulder up a hill forever. and this is supposed to read to us as torturous. And indeed it does. However, Albert Camus has this to say. The struggle itself towards the height is enough to fill a man's heart. One must imagine Sisyphus happy. Now, Albert Camus, he draws in this very potent metaphor, right? This metaphor of a guy rolling a boulder up a hill, and he says, we must imagine this man happy, because that is the absurd. The absurd is that we are Sisyphus. We are as Sisyphus, and we are tasked with the agonizing, torturous realization that we are born to push boulders up hills. Fuck. That's, oh, no, not that. It's very depressing. It's very, very stultifying. But Camus has this kind of turn at the end. He says, one must imagine him happy. Well, how can we imagine this man happy if he's being tortured? Well, that is the absurd. That is the absurdism. You must embrace your boulder. And you may do this by any means, but, you know, that's what we're going to get into, hopefully. So, the absurd, to recap. The world can be not only very cruel, but very uncaring. I wrote that down in my notes because I like that quote. I think the worst thing to realize about the world is it doesn't give a fuck about you, right? It can just go on without you. It doesn't matter. It doesn't care. And that's very damaging to the ego, right? In a very visceral sense, psychologically. But we can overcome this by sort of accepting that, yes, the world can go on without us, but there is also something that cannot go on without us, and that is us, right? I don't think Albert Camus ever says that outright. That might be an invention of my brain. I might have heard it somewhere. I don't know. But we cannot go on without ourselves, and we are here for a while, so we might as well fucking do something with it. So now I'm going to tie this all back to Homestuck, because that's why you clicked on this thing. So there it is. I have 5 case studies with 5 different characters and their sort of status as absurd heroes. Now, case study 1 is everyone's favorite character, Vriska. Now, Vriska is a... specifically when I'm talking about Vriska, I'm talking about parenthesis Vriska, the one who becomes a punk, not the one who is revived in the retcon. But Vriska struggles against the world at every turn. She struggles against the world when she's alive on Alternia, and she struggles with the world after she dies and goes into the dream bubbles. She struggles even though she doesn't really have to. She's dead now. But she does. And she becomes very engrossed by it. It becomes her boulder that she's rolling up this hill, right? And she achieves a great deal. She finds the house juju. But she also suffers. She suffers great rejection by John. She suffers great rejection by her peers, by Aranya abandoning her and Mina. And she suffers a great deal by pursuing Mina as well. There's a quote from The Myth of Sisyphus. Man is always prey to his truths. Once he has admitted them, he cannot free himself from them. Vriska is stuck with her truth. And her truth, much like Sisyphus's boulder, gives her a great deal of meaning. She wants to be a hero, right? She wants to be a hero when she goes to fight Bec Noir. She wants to be a hero when she finds the house juju. And she wants to be a hero throughout the whole narrative, even after she is literally dead and in the ground. But she overcomes this. She overcomes her own truth. This gives her a great deal of pleasure, giving up this truth. She embraces Mina. After she is rejected by Mina, obviously she goes back and reunites with Terezi, the Terezi that died in the retcon. So in this way, in her quixotic nature, why did I say quixotic? What is that? That's not a word, is it? It's quixotic, right? Either way, doesn't matter. She gives up her truth of heroism and pursues something else, and this is greatly to her benefit. This is her journey, her arc. Nothing is wasted. She is able to be a complete person, basically, by, you know, following her whims, by doing things that are not easy but very difficult, by accepting herself. And the last scene we see of her is her embracing Terezi and being very happy. And I think that's kind of nice. It's random. It's totally fucking random. Like, the outcomes of her efforts are incredibly random and absurd and fucked up and weird. And she gets insanely sad, but she ends up through it a happy person. By chance, certainly, but by chance as well as her own positive attitude. And that's kind of a confusing thing to say, right? It's not very, like I said, it's not good for the ego, but it's good for you, the person, the consciousness. It's like accepting that the world might be fucked up is not easy, or accepting the world does not revolve around us is not easy. And accepting our struggles might be for nothing is not easy either. The boulder is always going to roll down the hill, but that's how it is. The second case study I have is a little more clear cut. I wanted to start with Vriska because she's a popular character. That's it. And I like her. I know the most about her. The second case study is Dave. Let's hear another quote from The Myth of Sisyphus here from Albert Camus. A man wants to earn money in order to be happy, and his whole effort and the best of a life are devoted to the earning of that money. Happiness is forgotten. The means are taken for an end. Now, this is, again, some dense wordage, but let's explain it like this. Have you ever been at your job and thought, this is fucking miserable, I hate this, but I gotta be here to make money? And you're kind of missing something there when you think like that. You're missing the fact that, like, okay, you want to make money to make yourself happy later, but right now you are goddamn miserable, my friend. And that's not a good way to be. And, you know, maybe you shouldn't have a job that makes you fucking miserable. Because a lot of people I know, I have a job, for instance, I have a day job. I work at a farm market, a front desk. And I really like that job, genuinely. I like customer service. I like talking to people. I like, you know, being a manager, stuff like that. And a while ago, some of my coworkers left for a different job, which was in insurance. And I had an opportunity myself to do this because I have a bachelor's degree and that was the only requirement. And they said, hey, you should apply. It's more money. And I thought, yeah, it would be more money, but it would crush my fucking soul because I've complained about the insurance company ad nauseum and I'm not trying to, you know, do that. And that's kind of counterintuitive, but I think it's kind of wraps up what this quote means. The means are taken for an end. The job is taken as your life, basically. You know what I mean? If you've ever had a shitty job, if you've never had a shitty job and you're listening to this, well, congratulations, but most of us have to have shitty jobs. And they're a little shitty. Even my job is a little shitty, but I mostly like it. But how does this pertain to Dave? How does this, you know, talk about jobs pertain to our buddy, the time wizard? Well, Dave, of his own volition, he gives up his powers. He sees that they're making him miserable, and so he simply says, I'm not going to use them anymore. I'm not going to, you know, mistake the means for the end. I'm not going to be the time guy just because I'm the time guy. I'm going to stop doing this. And indeed, for the rest of the comic, the only times he uses them are when he is compelled to by Jade. He refuses to do so. Sorry, my cats are fighting. I don't know if you can hear that. Dave is a very wise character. That's kind of an underrated facet of Dave. He's not very good interpersonally. He kind of reads to me as like kind of a, I don't know, he's got Asperger's or something. He can't relate to people, but he is very wise. That's, I mean, Asperger's in like the actual sense. I'm not trying to be derogatory here. I think he, you know, there's a case to be made that he actually has Asperger's. More on that later, maybe in a different video. But yeah, he sees what brings him happiness, and he's very easily able to be like, yeah, I don't want to do what makes me miserable anymore. That just doesn't sound fun, right? And this the myth of Sisyphus kind of, in my mind, kind of breaks down here because Sisyphus cannot abandon his what makes him miserable, but we're going to ignore that for the sake of the metaphor. That brings us to case study number three, Dave's friend Rose, Dave's sister Rose. Here's another quote that will lead us into Rose's discussion. Without culture, and the relative freedom it implies, society, even when perfect, is but a jungle. This is why any authentic creation is a gift to the future. Wow. I like that one. That one's simple. That one's easy to understand. Let's take it in two parts. Without culture and the relative freedom it implies, society, even when perfect, is but a jungle. We've all felt this, right? We've all seen Mean Girls, where she compares, you know, a civilized society to a jungle. We've all felt that. We've all felt the connection to our animal predecessors, even in sort of quote-unquote civilized society. If you've ever seen a bar fight, my friends, you have seen the ape in man, right? If you've ever, you know, seen two people argue, if you've ever been, you know, witness to a stupid fucking argument, especially between men, then you have seen the animal nature of humanity. And that is something we cannot be free of. Now let's take the second part of the quote. This is why any authentic creation is a gift to the future. Wow. That's nice. Again, Camus has this thing where he says something incredibly fucking depressing. That we're all fucking apes and animals and we can't control it. No matter how much trappings we have. But then he turns it around and says, but isn't it cool that we kind of do have these trappings that we can provide for our future like this? That's wonderful. I really like that. It gives me a sense of purpose, even in an absurd world. Now, Rose, this pertains to her because she is a seer. She sees the future. Now, this kind of goes for Rose in Act 6 when she kind of has her shit together a little more until she gets drunk. She undertakes a great many forward-thinking goals, like her FAQ, for instance, and her little guide that she's writing on the meteor. She is very devoted to the future and sees that the universe will not provide by default, right? If the universe is cruel, we must undertake to make it less cruel, even some small amount. And she must provide actively, and she takes joy in this. That's very critical. Rose embraces this boulder. She says, I do not mind that this is difficult, and I actually enjoy pushing this rock uphill, even though some of my efforts will be inevitably wasted. I don't know, that's pretty clear cut to me. I really like Rose. She's very straightforward with her motivations, usually. Now let's bring to case study 4. This is one of my favorite ones. I saved it for the end, or near the end.
Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm yawning. Goodness gracious.
I'm recording this at 1 a.m. Here's a quote for Roxy. The human heart has a tiresome tendency to label as fate only what crushes it. But happiness, likewise, in its way, is without reason, since it is inevitable. Think about that one. Again, this is something incredibly depressing with something wonderful brought out of it. Let's take this in two parts again. The human heart has a tiresome tendency to label fate as only what crushes it. How can we can relate to that, right? Anyone has, had a moment in their life where they're like, this fucking sucks. Why is my fate to be here? Right? We have this sense of fate. But we only invoke fate when we're talking about something bad, right? We only talk about inevitability when we're talking about something unfortunate, like, you know, oh, I have cancer. Why must this happen to me? But we never think about that when we're happy, right? We never think about fate when we are pleased. We never think about luck. And you could relate to this to Vriska with all her talk of fate too, but I want to relate it to Roxy. Because Roxy is a fascinating character to me. She is probably the most miserable character in all of Homestuck. She is drunk. She is alone. She is without companion. She is left out of the love triangle that consumes the rest of her friends. And everyone around her kind of betrays her in some way. But she is the most absurd character in all of Homestuck, because every single nugget of happiness she can draw out of the world, she squeezes it from like rock, like blood from a boulder, right? She never takes for granted her friends. She betters herself constantly, and she takes difficult avenues to do so. This is very critically absurd. She sees that the life is meaningless. She sees that nothing is real. As a void player, she's, you know, directly in contact with this, and yet she says, no, I'm going to be happy instead. I'm going to be upbeat, I'm going to be cheerful, and I'm going to be a beacon of light to my fucking friends. And she is. She is a luminous beacon among her depressed and horrible friends, and she's probably the most outwardly cheerful in all of the cast, right? Except maybe like Nepeta, who we love. We love Nepeta. Roxy accepts happiness instead of wallowing in fear. And I really admire her for that. She draws herself out of being drunk on her own, which I don't think is very realistic, but is very admirable. She is she's a role model in all of Homestuck. I really love Roxy. I don't think it could be understated. And I don't think it's a coincidence that she is a void player. Void is an aspect associated with nothingness and meaninglessness, and yet she is very cheerful and happy. The other void players, who are Equius and his ancestor, and Dancestor rather, are just kind of these oblivious motherfuckers. And by contrast, Roxy draws a lot of meaning from nothingness, which is her power, literally. It's pretty cool. I don't think I need to explain more here. Like, just Roxy's awesome. I've talked about this before. Roxy, fucking cool. I don't know. I don't have anything more to say. I wish I did. I wish this was more complicated so I could talk about it more, but I think you get what I'm saying. That brings us to the final case study, which is Caliborn. Now, I talked about Caliborn in the last video about Homestuck and Gnosticism. And I think a lot of actually what I said there pertains to this. Let's start with the quote from Camus. "What can meaning outside my condition mean to me? I can understand only in human terms. What I touch, what resists me, that is what I understand." Let's break this down. Camus asks, "What can a meaning outside my condition mean to me?" Now, outwardly, this kind of seems hedonistic. Like, you know, anything outside of me is meaningless. Like, I'm the center of the world, whatever. I don't think that's what he means, because he goes on to say, "I can understand only in human terms. I can understand only in human terms." He's not saying I am the only thing that is real. I'm the only thing that matters. He is saying I am the only thing I can understand. I must filter my experiences through myself, my senses, my five senses. He uses touch for his example, but he says, "What I touch, what resists me, that is what I understand." He is saying I have a very limited outlook, and I must act upon it, because that is my nature. He accepts human nature, and I like that. Now, Caliborn is not a human, but he also does this. He also accepts his nature. His goals, Caliborn's goals, to be, you know, to be fucking Lord English, they're very tactile, they're very direct, and they're very whimsical. And by whimsical, I do not mean like lighthearted, I mean based on Caliborn's whims. He does what he wants because he wants to. That's as simple as, right? In absurdism, there's this big thing about doing things for their own sake. Not in a hedonistic way again, but in a sort of absurd way. Like, we must do something because it is... Now I'm burping. I'm yawning, now I'm burping. We must do things not because they are easy, not because they are hedonistic, but because they are what we want to do. We must commit to what we want to do. And by God, Caliborn commits to what he wants to do. He accepts his condition, even though it's rather shit. He lives in a fucking cave on the moon. He's shackled to his garbage sister, who he hates. And even though he's an evil guy, he accomplishes greatness. He does. That's undeniable. He is a slave to his whims. And, you know, again, this is somewhat depressing. We are a slave to our boulder. We are a slave to our whims. But he wants, and he takes. And by taking directly and asking the universe for what he wants, he gets it. We must, like Caliborn, accept our wants and take them, even if they may seem repulsive. And that's a very hard lesson to learn, but it's incredibly vital. A lot of guilt is instilled into us by society and by sort of philosophy at large, by psychology, by all these other, metrics. I don't like that, right? It's not good to be ashamed. You have to want, you have to take, and you are only able to filter your experiences through yourself. That doesn't mean, obviously, you know, just become an unfiltered mess of a person or never be ashamed of yourself. But it means, you know, maybe move yourself into a position where you can be who you want to be. Maybe that's within your control. Accept responsibility for your own happiness, essentially. And again, that's not easy. It's easier said than done. It's not easy. It's easier to just go along with society and sort of take the prescribed notions with you. I'm struggling with that myself. I struggle a lot with that, but I'm getting better at it. You must carve out a niche for yourself. You must live unapologetically. Because guess what? We don't know what the fuck comes after this. So it's imperative that while you have something you know, this life, you make it good, right? And if you don't, the boulder's going to crush you, buddy. It's going to roll right over you. That's no good either. And it's not going to be easy. But if you don't do it, if you don't take responsibility for your happiness, if you don't start taking estrogen, if you don't, you know, get off the booze, if you don't do that, you're going to be fucking miserable. You know what makes you miserable. You don't need me to tell you that. Unless you are, you know, suffering from some kind of severe delusion, you know what's making you miserable, and you know how to fix it, probably. You just have to take the steps, and you got to fucking kick yourself in the ass to do it. And, you know, it's not going to be easy. You might have to hit rock bottom. I don't know. But Caliborn tells us that this pays off. It's good. To conclude this out, before I hit the half an hour mark, because I don't want to make this too long, Homestuck is an absurd work. Its characters are absurd, as I've said before, from Vriska to Dave to Rose to Roxy to Caliborn. They're all absurd in different ways. But the narration is also very absurd, both in the philosophical sense, as we've discussed, but also in the just generally, you know, general definitional sense, right? It's absurd. It's crazy. It's wacky. It often diverges. The narrative diverges whimsically, and it actively alienates the reader. It is not just of absurd heroes, but absurd content, right? Hussey wants to examine this world in a very whimsical way, and that allows the reader to fill in the blanks, which is to Homestuck's credit. I think it's one of the better aspects of the work itself, but it's absurd. It's crazy. It's wacky. It's goofy, and I love it. And, you know, for all its faults, for all its many faults, it's still pretty good, and it still offers a great deal of insight into life, I think, especially when viewed from a lens like some kind of philosophy, right? Now, I'm going to wrap this up, but this is going up on Patreon first. If you want to see this stuff early, it's on Patreon. Subscribe to me there, you know, just to support me, because I appreciate it. And thank you for listening. I know I can ramble. I hope I was articulate. And everyone have a great day. I really, really do want you to have a great day. If you don't have a great day, well, let's just say I'm going to be pissed off. All right, everybody. See you later.